So our second presentation here is pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, understanding and optimizing clinical decision-making. And I'll turn it over to the speakers.
Okay, perfect. So I'm Sinead. I'm an academic clinician. So I spend most of my time working at a maternity care center called The Womb, The World of My Baby. And then when I'm not at The Womb, I am at McMaster University where I teach and conduct research.
And my name is Gracie Alanis. I'm an orthopedic and pelvic health physiotherapist, primarily working out of Chatham and partly out of London. And I'm a recent graduate of McMaster's physiotherapy program.
So before we launch into this, I did just want to acknowledge other collaborators on this work, Sylvia Daniel and Yasmin DeGroot, who just weren't able to be here today. So what we're going to go through is we'll give a little bit of a backdrop around pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, and I think some of the sort of global concepts about how we have to be thinking about pain and this sort of evolved perspective from Kathleen will be really, really helpful as we kind of go through this. And then I will be turning it over to Gracie, and she's going to walk you through two studies that we ran just to kind of further our understanding related to how we actually make decisions about pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. And then we'll kind of tie it back in the end in terms of sort of implications and future directions and where do we likely potentially need to go. So where all this kind of started out was trying to figure out the answer to the question, is pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain primarily a musculoskeletal issue? And this was a question that popped up in, I guess, more of a sort of overt, explicit way as I was doing some teaching at McMaster University in the physiotherapy program and getting to the point that, you know, as our understanding of pain science and these psychological factors and social factors and how that all plays in, as our understanding of those pieces have evolved, it was evident to me that how we were teaching our students, we weren't doing really a great job of reconciling the mechanics or the biomechanics with some of these sort of emerged understandings. And this crystallized a little bit really obviously for me when it came time to, in Unit 6 at the end of the student's program, to teach around pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. And it was glaringly obvious to me that how that had been done was sort of reverting back to this biomechanical model, which essentially we know we just don't have enough substantiation to continue thinking about this issue in this particular way. So then that kind of got us thinking, well, okay, so, you know, this is certainly what I'm seeing from a teaching perspective. And then from a clinical perspective, because of course I work in a maternity care center, this is a clinical issue I deal with quite a bit. And certainly as I've evolved my own practice more in line with how we currently have to think of pain and understand this problem, it was evident to me that that actually works much better than this kind of biomechanical way of looking at things. So as we go through, we're going to kind of be coming back to sort of thinking about this question. So what do we know about pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain? Well, we know that women who have this condition also have a lot of other comorbid conditions. And certainly Peter O'Sullivan and colleagues in some of their recent papers have really indicated we really got to look at these factors outside of the biological piece and the biomechanical piece. We also see another quite recent evidence that, you know, pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain is also characterized by widespread sensitivity in the other tissues. So we're starting to see that there are these central mechanisms at play. Again, looking at really much higher rates of depression, anxiety, and other issues, there's lots of literature to substantiate this piece. We know that while there's a really high prevalence of this condition to begin with, there's also a pretty high prevalence of persistency and quite severe persistency, right? So again, we know that there's got to be these central mechanisms at play. And then when we look at some of the other social pieces around work dissatisfaction, and even if you think of sort of pregnancy and becoming a mother and then you're leaving the workplace and then you're going back again, there's a whole layers of social context that I don't even really think that we've adequately touched that likely are also influencing. And then some really well-done qualitative research indicated how critical it was that specifically for pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, that treatment really needs to focus around developing self-efficacy and really kind of applying those cognitive strategies rather than mechanical strategies. So this actually highlights a study that was started by a group of researchers at the University College Cork. And I've been fortunate enough to start to collaborate with this team, and we're going to be moving forward doing some of this research together. And basically what this team sort of set out to do was acknowledging that the traditional mechanical way that typically physiotherapists in Ireland, how they've sort of handled pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, really didn't work that well, essentially. So, you know, instead applying treatment more termed as stress reduction therapy, that's sort of what they call it over there, but it's very similar to how we would apply pain neuroscience education, how we would apply mindfulness and novel movements, and all of those pieces that we've started to do more as our evolution of pain science has progressed. And, you know, what they have found was actually that this works really, really well. So again, you're focusing more on these kind of central mechanisms rather than the mechanics, and we're getting some really good results. So we have this evolved understanding, right, that we know we have these central mechanisms that are really, really critical. And then we have these very, very recent clinical practice guidelines that were first published as a document in 2016, but are now published in a journal in 2017. And as although these guidelines really do start to move our thinking related to this condition, kind of from a biopsychosocial perspective, so certainly a huge improvement from previous guidelines, still within the document is this inability to sort of leave behind ways of knowing that we just know are not the case, right? And it really speaks to what we were just talking about in terms of evolving our thinking as we go through and being okay with leaving the fact that this is not a musculoskeletal issue, but throughout this document, they keep reverting to framing it as a musculoskeletal issue. So that's something that I think even our literature, we have to be kind of mindful of and how that's kind of getting thread through. So with all this backdrop, we really want to see, okay, well, how are most physios in Ontario situating this problem, and how are they making decisions about women in terms of how they're doing assessment, how they're doing treatment? Like, what is going on in our province? What's happening? So I will turn it over to Gracia.
All right, so just to give some context, both of these studies were done as MSCPT student projects. So the first one was done by students in the graduating class of 2016, and the second one was done by myself and Yasmin, who were the class of 2017. All right, so in terms of the initial study, they looked at physiotherapists who were practicing in Ontario, specifically within the public sector. So they were looking at individuals who were working within family health teams, community health centers, as well as different hospitals that really focused on the pregnant population. They also wanted to create a data extraction tool to be able to collect their data, and they based it off of best evidence at the time. Now, keep in mind, as what Sinead just mentioned, it was the clinical practice guidelines that were available, so there is some fallback in terms of the evidence when you look at the clinical practice guidelines and the pain research. So there is some differences between the two, but that's what the students had available to them at the time. They also wanted to make sure they had a standardized process when they were collecting their data. So they did an interview process and made a standardized script to be able to follow that. And they did it over the phone as well as through an electronic survey to be able to reach out to as many practitioners as possible. So in terms of what they were looking for and what they were assessing, they looked at three different domains, including assessment strategies, management strategies, and as well as looking at awareness of and attitudes related to clinical practice guidelines. It was also important that the students included the clinical vignette because research does show that when you do look at or apply a clinical vignette, you're able to assess people's knowledge and clinical decision-making a little bit more accurately compared to just a survey. So in this particular study, there were 67 people that they reached out to, 17 of which completed it, but we had 40 people not respond and 10 withdraw. And the reason is because these individuals actually did not feel that they were adequately skilled to treat this particular population, even though they actually had pregnant women within their practice. So it's kind of an interesting gap in terms of the type of care they were able to provide their patients. And so in terms of the completed responses, we had 9 primary care practitioners complete it and 8 tertiary care. So tertiary care is relating to the hospital system. So in terms of the results, again, going back to those 3 domains, we looked under assessment, and we really wanted to look at the orthopedic tests that people were conducting to be able to diagnose or look into pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain. And so we found that participants actually did utilize recommended tests based off of those clinical practice guidelines, which the most frequently used were compression, distraction, Fabers, as well as palpation of the long dorsal ligament. Then looking at outcome measures in terms of seeing what types of outcome measures these individuals use to assess different measures, we found that actually none of the participants discussed any of the outcome measures within the clinical practice guidelines. And so we're looking at the Quebec Back Disability Index, the Disability Rating Index, and the Yales-Westry Disability Rating Index as well. So those are actually based off of the European guidelines. So in looking at treatment, as you can see, the majority of individuals actually stated that they would prescribe some sort of stabilization exercise. A little over a third stated that they would do some sort of mobilization, with a little under half indicating that they would provide other strategies, including education as being the most cited. However, there was no mention of pain science education. And in terms of how this related to the clinical practice guidelines, they did actually fall under the recommendations. However, we're looking at these strategies are actually listed at level C and D in terms of those types of levels of evidence. So overall, as was mentioned, it's pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain is actually quite underserviced within this particular group of physiotherapists. And there was also a lack of awareness of these clinical practice guidelines. Although individuals did state that they had a positive attitude towards them. Then looking to see exactly how this all related to the best practice, we did find that people were utilizing those stability exercises, which is recommended by the current clinical practice guidelines at the time. And then we did have a small subset of individuals actually reference cognitive and motivational strategies, which we know from the research does help facilitate self-management and develop self-efficacy within this population, which is quite important. And then again, individuals are not using the recommended outcome measures. So going into the second study, and we looked at the private sector, so I'll just go ahead and go into that. So we looked at, again, physiotherapists working within Ontario, and they were working within a private practice setting. Okay, so we use a very similar data extraction tool compared to the first study. We just adapted it to be able to actually reflect the environment of a private practice physiotherapist. And we also wanted to make it readily available to these practitioners, so we made it available through SurveyMonkey. In terms of the content, very similar to the first study, we looked at assessment and treatment strategies, as well as looking at awareness and attitudes towards clinical practice guidelines. What was interesting is that we actually had access to the most recent clinical practice guidelines when we started our study. So that's the American Physical Therapy Association clinical practice guidelines that were done by Clinton et al. In 2016. And again, same reason as last time, we wanted to include clinical vignettes because we know the research does support that. So in our study, we had 78 individuals respond to our study, 44 of which completed the survey. 10 were excluded because they didn't actually work in Ontario. 13 were orthopedic physiotherapists who completed the survey, and 31 were pelvic health physiotherapists. So when looking at our results, we really actually wanted to look into the different types or domains of pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, which include SIJ pain, pelvic girdle dysfunction, as well as pubic symphysis pain. And all of the tests listed on here are actually recommended by the European and the most recent clinical practice guidelines. And there actually is quite a high number of individuals who are selecting these particular tests. So they are actually using tests that are recommended by the practice guidelines. But as you can see, they're very biomechanical in nature. Now going on to the outcome measures. So these are the outcome measures that are actually recommended by the most recent clinical practice guidelines from 2016. And as you can see, there's a really low level of individuals who actually selected these outcome measures. And we actually also had the option of other, so we actually were able to see what other types of outcome measures people were reporting in case the ones that we had in our multiple choice were not there. But individuals still selected a very low number of outcome measures that were related to those ones that are recommended. All right, so now going on to treatment strategies. Again, very similar to the first group, they found that stability or motor control exercise was very important for them to prescribe. We didn't look into whether or not individuals actually knew the difference between the two or if they thought they were the same. So we can't make a comment on that. But we did find individuals also felt that it was appropriate to provide a pelvic belt or a supportive belt to address pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain, as well as almost all of our participants would provide postural advice and activity modification. And we also had a little under two-thirds state that they would provide some sort of mobilization or manual therapy, and a low number of individuals would provide acupuncture. Now, going back and actually reflecting on the clinical practice guidelines, what's interesting is that there's quite a disparity between the answers and the clinical practice guidelines, specifically with the most recent ones. So when we actually look at exercise in the American Physical Therapy Association guidelines, it actually does not state anything about stability or motor control exercises. It actually just promotes general exercise according to the most recent obstetric and gynecological clinical practice guidelines. So there isn't anything specific about motor control or stability. Looking at pelvic belt use, it's actually recommended by both the European and the most recent clinical practice guidelines. However, it's only indicative if it actually changes a person's pain, as well as it can only be used in a short term because long term is not actually found in research. And what's interesting in terms of the European versus the most recent clinical practice guidelines is that there's also a disparity between postural advice. So the most recent clinical practice guidelines actually state that posture is not related to, and we should not be telling our patients that their pain is actually indicative of their posture during pregnancy. So that's something that's actually quite different. It's actually coming through the pain science research that posture is not related to someone's pain experience. And again, with manual therapy, unfortunately, because of the low level of evidence, it was also given a level C rating just because of the methodology of the research. And then acupuncture was actually given the highest rating in the European practice guidelines, as it was actually considered to have a level B evidence, but only 12% of individuals actually selected it. So overall, we found individuals were using assessment strategies that were in line with the clinical practice guidelines, but again, those are very biomechanical in nature. Very few individuals are actually looking at outcome measures, and a lot of the outcome measures that are actually recommended are actually taking into account the biopsychosocial factors that Sinead was talking about. In terms of treatment strategies, the focus again is on level C and D strategies, and really no mention of any pain neuroscience or motivational and cognitive strategies. And we also found that individuals had a lack of awareness of those clinical practice guidelines.
Great. So where that kind of led us was that what we found in these two studies was sort of congruent with what other researchers have found. So Carolyn Van Dyken and Sandy Hilton, they wrote a paper and indicated that, yeah, physiotherapists tend to still preferentially, when it comes to any form of pelvic pain, tend to really preferentially use a biomechanical or sort of musculoskeletal model, even though we have a lot of information to suggest we shouldn't be doing that, right? And also, as Gracia indicated, people seem to be doing the MSK piece of this, and that is a piece of this, really well. What's not done well are the other components, right? I think as our understanding evolves and our science evolves, hopefully this will change. And certainly the clinical practice guidelines we have now is definitely a step forward, but still I don't think a strong enough departure from previous ways of knowing that we just know aren't accurate, right? That's where that allyship concept comes up, even relative to this particular work. So we know that these central mechanisms are at play. That's very, very evident and is coming out in different ways in a whole variety of studies in different countries. We also know that these cognitive approaches in our care, and not just for this population, that kind of goes across the board, are really, really important, right? And emerging science is coming out, even trying to really push physios to actually do a better job with some of the basic lifestyle pieces that are going to activate these different biological systems and assist with these central factors. So the education that was discussed by our participants actually in both studies, it was good that education was a big piece of the majority of the participants, but not once, and the first study was all phone interviews, so we had a lot of opportunity to dialogue, not once was it specifically cited pain neuroscience education, not once. Education was around posture or changes in activity modification and those very traditional mechanical pieces. And I think, you know, really we need to push past that. We know that pain neuroscience education is effective. It's confirmed in 13 RCTs, 3 systematic reviews and counting, and there's more and more research. So it's something that I think we really need to do a bit of a better job of integrating. But even as educators, I think we need to do a better job of threading this through the curriculum in a way that's going to translate the knowledge better. So then that kind of leads us to this question. If we answer the first question and say, okay, well now hopefully we're convinced that, you know, this isn't really just a musculoskeletal issue. This is a bigger issue that's really multifaceted and is layered with a whole bunch of components, including social context. So if that's the case, so then how do we optimally go about working with women with this condition, right? And, you know, I think we have a little bit of a start with our clinical practice guidelines. Certainly, I'm excited to continue working with Siobhan O'Manny and her team to really look a little bit more into this piece around autonomic nervous system, the HPA axis and stress, and focusing that way and see where we get. But I think we have more work to do to launch off of the understandings that we do have that really starts with that biopsychosocial piece. And thank you if anyone has any questions. I think it just might be a little bit more obvious or crystallized for this issue, because I think traditionally, like certainly how I was even taught or understood or trained as a physio when I was, I really thought of pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain as kind of more of an acute MSK, like you're pregnant for a very specific amount of time, mechanics are changing when you're pregnant, right? Really wasn't thinking about the central pieces at all, where I think, even if I think from the perspective of a student's understanding, and Gracia will have some good insight in this, I think there is a better understanding of other forms of musculoskeletal pain, understanding that there isn't necessarily that timeline on it where you could think of it as being more acute. So I think that's where this one is a little bit unique, but I mean, we have emerging science even in terms of how different hormones in our immune system are communicating with sort of our nervous system, and there's some suggestion that when you have estrogen and progesterone in a particular ratio, that seems to have a particular response in terms of pain sensitivity, and there's a whole piece around that that we're starting to understand. And of course, some of that is bio, right? Some of that is the biology and the physiology. But I think we have moved beyond the biomechanics, and this is not an acute biomechanical situation. But what was so stark to me in how we were running our education at McMaster is it reverted back to that. It reverted back to approaching it from that perspective as students are about to leave the curriculum. And so that was something that myself and Jordan Miller had to revamp and spend a lot of time on. So that's kind of where that all came. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, that's great.
Carolyn.
Thank you, Mr. Would our midwife colleagues have
share with us, because they were probably becoming not, from a physio thinking point of view, we would be, you know, although we need to evolve, we would be looking at that biomechanical first. I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. So I have the luxury of, I work right alongside with midwives at the womb. And again, even the little training that they get, they are still come out of their schooling with the notion that pregnancy-related pelvic girdle pain is mechanical, and most of them are kind of programmed to send them off to a chiro, actually. So, we got some work to do. Yeah, we got some work to do.
It's just interesting. I would have thought with the midwife, just in terms of their philosophy.
Exactly.
Wait a year, and then we'll have some research on that, hopefully.
Yes. Yeah, we're doing a project actually at the moment that kind of ties in the interprofessional sort of understanding of pelvic health concerns. So stay tuned.
Right. Thank you.
I'll review the clinical practice guidelines, of course, after you talked about them. But can you say what the recommended outcome measures are that incorporate the psychosocial components from the most recent?
Let Tracy speak to that.
So for the American Physical Therapy Association guidelines, based off of the European ones, they both indicated like the disability rating index and the Oswestry disability questionnaire, but they actually added the pain catastrophizing scale, which is actually quite a significant outcome measure to kind of look at that central pain aspect. I'd have to actually go back to the slide.
Fear avoidance.
Yeah, fear avoidance was also another one. So they just added that recently. Yeah.
Is there another question at the back?
I'm just thinking part of it is that why maybe physios don't want to talk about some of these other things is we always don't want to talk about those. Right? We like the biomedical world, right? We don't want to say really there's some other issues, feeling either because we don't feel we have the skills or behavior or knowledge base to tackle some of these things, and also that we aren't educated on how to provide education. Mm-hmm. So my research interest is patient education, and I don't think we job. We talk a lot about, and then you'll provide patient education, but we don't often give students specific skills and knowledge about adult learning principles and all those things that would help me say, I understand it conceptually about the neuroscience, but how to address this issue. And then if we link with the previous presentation, the cultural, ESL, all those other factors. So we just go, it's good, I'll just do this part. Someone else on the team's going to do that part.
I would agree with that. And I think, too, like when it comes to education, and this was always a bit of a soapbox thing for me as a professor at MAC, is, you know, counseling and engaging with a client in a collaborative way to help them develop self-efficacy is different than education, right? Counseling and education are totally different. And so that was all, that continues to be a tricky thing for our students, because they think, education. But actually to really develop those cognitive and motivational skills to do that well, it does require practice. It does require you to understand that piece is different than education. But I find too, students don't as much have the readiness to uptake that. They really want the other pieces. And so in ways there's pressure on faculty to provide those, right? So it's tricky.
Totally. And, you know, we could have this whole discussion. That's my concern, is education becomes this one thing, and I see it extremely globally. Mm-hmm. So it's any information, it's how we're doing it, it's coaching, it's mentoring, it's all those components we do with patients all the time.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it's always seen, you know, do five this, and I'll write it in my chart, right? I did this and provided patient education. We never write down what we did. Nobody's did that, you know. So I was saying we spent 20 minutes talking about the neuro things. So.
Yeah, I agree.
As a therapist working in the field for students that are coming out and going to be starting their careers, are there any kind of key questions that you have up your sleeve to kind of engage in those conversations, or any courses that you recommend in developing those skills early in our careers?
So I'll give my perspective first and then I'll let Gracie say it. I would definitely say, like, everyone should sort of have like an explain pain course under their belt, just to kind of get some of the basics. I think the better, even as therapists, we really understand the system from those different perspectives, and the more different analogies we've been exposed to that we can try out with different people, the better we're going to do at that. So I really think like an explain pain type of course should be in every physio's toolbox. You know, I can say certainly at McMaster, we were really blessed to have Jordan Miller for a couple years,
whose expertise is in pain to help shape the curriculum, but of course, he's not there anymore. So how that curriculum will be shaped down, like, it's hard to say, right? So I think you can't necessarily guarantee you're gonna get that info in the curriculum. So I would say definitely that's something I would suggest.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to kind of get exposed to pelvic health right away, and I took a course within pelvic health that really allowed me to gain some strategies to be able to actually approach a patient. But when I didn't have that in my toolkit, like honestly, I just talked to patients, and I just tried to get a sense of where they were coming from, and I didn't focus on their pain necessarily, I focused more on what was going on at home. So I just tried to get a sense of who they were as a person, what they cared about, and then try to address that within their program.
Okay, thank you.
Perfect. So thank you so much to all of our speakers for such thought-provoking presentations and to all of you for being such a wonderful audience. So it's just coming up to 10:30 now, so there is a networking and nutrition break for the next half an hour in the exhibit hall just down the hallway here. Thank you again so much.